A very warm welcome to everybody who is joining us today for our podcast on coronavirus, corona infection in India and in Germany. My name is Josef Dietl. I am CEO of ProDigipa, a company that strives to make businesses smarter. And I have with me my old friend and business associate, Sesha Sai.
Thanks, Josef.
Sai, would you tell us a little bit about yourself, please?
Sure. So I'm co-founder and director at Smart Commerce Solutions based out of Bangalore. And both Josef and me were working at SAP for many, many years. I was there at SAP from 1998, I believe, till about 2012. So during that period, I had a chance to see a lot of Germany as well as work with the Germans. And of course, I'm now based, I'm running my company out of Bangalore, so I hope I can bring some understanding of both the worlds together for this podcast.
Yeah, that sounds really promising, and no surprise, we've already had a couple of conversations ahead of time. So let's jump right in. What does India look like or feel like now that the coronavirus has hit you? What is your everyday experience these days? How has this shaped your normal life?
So at this point of time, we are in a complete lockdown. So this is a nationwide lockdown. So I think lockdown means different things to different countries. There's no accepted definition. So let me explain what the lockdown situation here in India is. So about 2 weeks ago, I think 2 to 3 weeks ago, we stopped all incoming international flights. So there is no way you can enter India using any scheduled commercial airline. And no ships are allowed. And given where India's geography is, you don't have people driving their cars into the country, right? So that's literally not possible. So there is really no way. We closed our borders externally. And now every city is locked down. Every village is locked down. It's a country of 1.3 billion people. All of us are locked up in the house. You cannot come out. All the shops are closed. All the restaurants are closed. All the schools, colleges, offices, everything is shut. Right, so it's a lockdown where you can stay in your house, you can do what you want, but you can't step out onto the road, except for buying essential commodities like medicines or grocery and things like that. And the advisory from that government is do not go to the hospitals or clinics, or do not go to meet your doctor unless it's an emergency. So that's the state, right? So those of us who are in professions which allow us to work from home continue to do so. And those of us who can't work from home simply are at home. That's life.
Yeah, thank you. That sounds a lot harsher than what is happening here in Germany these days. Our government has decided roughly along the same lines, but they are allowing us to go outside as long as we don't meet other people. So we can go outside and take a walk, for example, or go jogging, or go to the forest and go for a walk. As long as it's either people living in the same household in a group, or as long as you don't stop in the street and talk with other people.
But how far can you go?
I'm not aware of any limitation. So if I wanted to go to Hamburg, which is a couple of hundred kilometers, then there is no, technically speaking, there is probably no issue with that.
Yeah, so here is quite different. So if I step out of the house, so the police won't stop me if I'm going out to get groceries, let's say. But if I have a shop that's, where I really like to go and shop, which is about 3 kilometers away, not possible. You need to go to the shops that are close to your house. So think of this, a country of 1.3 billion people has been carved up into small cells of about, let's say, 1 kilometer each, right? So you can go out of the house, you can take a walk if you want, but within that 1 kilometer or half a kilometer, right? So not more. So in any direction, you can probably go like half a kilometer or at most a kilometer, and that's about it. Then you encounter police barricades and they would allow you to go only if you have good reasons to go. And the moment you hit state boundaries, those are hermetically sealed now for no reason, right? There's literally no way you can cross those boundaries.
Wow. That's
and
great.
I forgot to mention, and I mm-hmm. forgot to mention, the entire Indian railways are shut, so no trains ply, and no buses going, and no metro, right? The entire mm-hmm. public transportation system has been closed.
That's strict. You just said the railway system was shut down. That is, as far as I remember, India, that is huge. How many people are using the railway system every day, or how many people used to use the railway system every day?
Of the order of magnitude of about 23 million passengers every day. That's every... like the entire population of Australia moving on the Indian trains every day.
Oh, wow. Not bad. But this is how it affects you in everyday life. But what was the situation like, let's say, 4 or 6 weeks ago? How did you personally first hear about the coronavirus and about the potential impact it may have? What was life like back then? What is the comparison to today?
Where do I start, right? So there are things that have not changed at all. There are things that have changed dramatically, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at the number of cases or encountering people who are sick that you may know, it's the same. We have not come across any patient. The numbers are really very small, even at this point of time, right? So the numbers have grown exponentially, and it's we are on a path where we are probably doubling every 4 days. Probably now it's come down to about doubling every 6 days or something like that, of that order of magnitude. But the cumulative number of cases has just crossed 4,000, right? So in terms of what's happening in other parts of the world, it's not much. So if you go a month ago, there were literally no cases. It's what we were reading about what's happening in other countries. And the panic that it created, right? So so that is what was remarkable about this. So it's not so much about the health actually getting affected, but it's the panic getting created due to what's happening in the other countries that had a big impact to start with.
I mean, many of my friends were wondering what the situation in India was like, because many people know it is a very, very crowded place. Yes. I mean, Bangalore, for example, has as many inhabitants as the entire country of Belgium. And if an infectious disease like the COVID-19 disease starts to spread in such an environment, the situation can become really tough very quickly. What was the feeling like on your end when you realized that even countries like Italy were totally overwhelmed?
That's precisely what caused us a lot of fear at every levels of the society, whether it's the government or whether it's a common citizen, of all classes of people. That's precisely what the fear was. If Western European countries are struggling to manage this, how do we manage it, right? So we as a country have come a long way, but then we have a huge distance to travel before we have the kind of healthcare infrastructure that Western Europe has. So there is a lot of fear. That fear has not gone away, and that probably explains why the lockdown was so harsh, because we need to flatten the curve so that as we build the herd immunity, the number of cases that that get generated can be managed by the infrastructure here. And it also gives us time to build the infrastructure. So that explains why the lockdown has been structured the way it has been structured. Mm-hmm. But yes, if you thought that Bangalore was crowded, Yusuf, I bet you have never set foot in Mumbai.
You're right, I haven't.
Yeah, so I feel claustrophobic when I go to Mumbai.
Oh, that's so. Okay. And yeah, I mean, an average European will probably not be able to imagine what Bangalore feels like. I love the place.
Average Bangalorean feels the same way when we go to Mumbai.
just to put things in perspective.
Okay. So you mentioned India is starting to build an infrastructure to cope with the whole thing. You have, in our talks before the talk, you had mentioned a little bit what this infrastructure could look like. Would you mind explaining to us? Because one of the things I really love about India is the ability to improvise. That is just unbelievably great.
Yeah. So I hope so. It will get tested in the coming days as we eventually reach the peak, whenever that is, right? Whether it is 6 weeks or 8 weeks away, as it's being expected. So the healthcare infrastructure build-out is happening at multiple levels. One is the stockpiling of medicines. That's the easiest thing to do with this hydroxychloroquine. Now, I don't know whether you saw the report of the Americans and others demanding the medicine, right? So apparently Trump said there will be retaliation if India stops the supply of medicines. So that caused a lot of news here, let's put it that way. So there is a lot of build up that is going on, the stockpiling. We incidentally produce about 70% of the global supply of this drug, right? So that's the reason why there is a lot of pressure to manufacture, produce this, and then supply it all across the world. So that's one. The other part is about building out the hospitals. So what the government has done is that they have taken regular hospitals and converted them into dedicated coronavirus hospitals, because you need to keep the patients separate. You do not want to put coronavirus patients in a normal hospital because the chance of cross-infection is high. So in Bangalore, for example, they converted a hospital that has about 1,700 beds into a dedicated facility. The hospital currently is empty, literally empty, probably a dozen patients in there, but they are waiting. They're waiting for the patients to start arriving. And the same thing is happening across, right? Every city, every state, they're converting hospitals, making it into a dedicated coronavirus facility. So probably 100,000, 150,000 beds or probably more have been set up on a dedicated basis. But the belief somewhere is that this would not be adequate. So what they're now doing is they're taking Indian Railways, the non-air-conditioned coaches, and converting them into quarantine facilities. So the thought process here is that if I could convert about 20,000 coaches, each one of them can have about 9 or 10 beds, then you're talking of a huge number of quarantine beds as well as intensive care beds that would be available. And the advantage here is that the railway system is now empty, right? There are no trains plying, so we can use these coaches. At the same time, you can move this to any part of the country, right? If tomorrow there is an outbreak near Mumbai, as we are seeing it now, all the trains can be moved to Mumbai and then they can serve the patients there. And as Mumbai reaches the peak and then they start plateauing, and let's assume that on the other end of the country, if let's say Kolkata has an outbreak, then the entire capacity can be moved, right? So you can move, let's say, 50,000 beds or 100,000 beds across the country in about 48 hours. So that's what they are trying to do. So they have, I believe they have already converted about 5,000 coaches, and the rest are on the way. So that's the other thing that is happening. And of course, they are going ahead and manufacturing ventilators, manufacturing personal protective equipment, masks, and so on, right? So it's consumables, hard infrastructure, mobile infrastructure, everything.
Mm-hmm. As I said, Indian ability to improvise never ceases to amaze me. On the other side of the coin, you have mentioned the other day that there has been a big hiccup in Delhi. I think at that time, India had approximately 300 or 400 recorded infections. And then what happened?
So what happened was that this was a period when we were transitioning into lockdown. So that is when there were advisories and government orders that you're not allowed to have public events. We could still go about doing our regular business, but we have in India what is known as Section 144. So when Section 144 of the Indian law basically says that once it is ordered, more than five people cannot congregate
anywhere, right? Inside a building or on the road, anywhere. So that was that law was passed, right? Or that order was passed. But these guys, about 1,000 to 2,000 of them congregated. That's quite a few. And the problem is not the sheer numbers. The problem was more. This was a group of Islamic preachers, and they had come from other countries. They had come from Malaysia, they had come from Indonesia, they had come from Thailand, and many of these other countries. And these countries have had more cases than India at that point of time. And many of these people were infected. So they brought the infection into the country. They were asymptomatic when they entered. And they've all been in one building, 2,000 people, in one 6 or 8 story building. Just imagine the amount of crowding, right? So, and a lot of people got infected. What that meant was that the infection could spread very rapidly. So usually when people congregate, the rate of infection is usually 10-15%. I believe there was a cruise liner off Japan where about 18-20% of people, I believe, got infected. But here the rate of infection was about 40-50%, which was huge. Mm-hmm. And all these people went back to the their respective towns and villages, and they've carried the infection. So that has become a super spreader scenario for us. So the numbers have now gone up to 4,000 plus. And since this incident, every day, about 60-70% of the Delta new cases are people who either attended that congregation or are close relatives of people who attended that congregation, or doctors who treated the people from this congregation, or people who came into contact with this congregation. So that is what is the situation. The government has been doing contact tracing. They have traced more than 20,000 to 30,000 people who are in close contact with these people. And then they are kind of putting them into quarantine. That's an ongoing process because some of them are not cooperating. Some of them are refusing to come out in the open. They're not declaring that they attended. They're being hostile and so on. So they need to get police involved and so on. So this is now a quasi-criminal, quasi-public health emergency. Mm-hmm. So these people have traveled 1,000 to 2,000 kilometers from where the congregation happened. So we just take the town of Tamil Nadu, right? There is a state of Tamil Nadu, which is actually next to Karnataka. Bangalore is in Karnataka, right? So this is a neighboring state. They had like 10, 15, 20 cases, right? They were about 15th state in the country in terms of the number of coronavirus cases. Now they are number two. I believe they've crossed around 600 or 800 cases, right? So that order of magnitude. Pretty much all of them are related to this congregation. So this has caused a huge outbreak.
So basically we have a little lesson here in what happens if quarantine rules are violated. And that lesson can be transferred across all countries.
Yes.
Sounds like India is, on the one hand, quite in a hole, but on the other hand, also has a very decisive government that is doing the best to manage the situation. If we look into the future, what is your expectation? How is this going to change India?
That's a tough question. So we are crystal ball gazing now. Mm-hmm. So I believe there are a couple of things we can see changing right now. So my daughter is now attending her school online, right? So if I just look at the sheer number of schools and colleges that are going online, I think it has fundamentally changed how kids are learning these days. And this is especially important in a country like India. And at this point, I want to put in perspective the state of infrastructure in the country and how the infrastructure has gotten built up in the country. So we as a country have failed to build infrastructure in the first part of the previous century, right? So whether it was copper cables for telecom, we failed to build that. what we finally built out was fiber optics. So there is a lot of leapfrogging that's happening. So we failed the first generation and second generation technologies, and now we are catching up with the third generation. Education is the same way, right? So I don't think we will ever manage to build the number of schools, colleges, and hire the number of teachers like United States or Western Europe did. I don't think we will ever manage to do that. But with the way the online education is picking up, that will ensure that many more people have access to education and quality education, right? So what this has done is to really push online education along, right? Which I think will have a huge positive impact in improving the educational outcomes of the country. So I think that is something that I can see happening right now, but I believe that the positive influence will carry on for many, many years, right? We will see the positive impact probably a couple of decades from now. That's one. The second one is the rapid pace at which people are now getting into manufacturing, right? So even at our stage of development, there is a lot of manufacturing that went away to China. Simply because of the labor laws in India, even though it's not really an affluent country, but the rules are what they are, and we can't match the salaries that are given to workers in China or Bangladesh or Thailand. So a lot of manufacturing actually moved away. But now some of them are coming back. When we see ventilators, personal protective equipment for doctors, masks, medicines, and so on, right? So a lot of it is coming back rapidly. I see that becoming a lasting trend, that the really critical stuff, at least, people would want to manufacture it here. That is a mixed situation is how I see it, because on one end, it's good that some of this is coming back. But at the other end, Germany might decide that I want to build software back home and I don't want to build it in Bangalore. So that won't be so positive after all. So we have to see how it evolves, right? So some of it, I believe, would be positive. Some of it, not so positive. We have to see.
Yeah, what I liked most was your expectation about how this may affect the self-consciousness of the Indian people.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, thanks for reminding me of that. So here is a small number. So we have one of the lowest number of ventilators per 100,000 people, right? So if you just look at that on compare it across countries, we have very small numbers. One reason was that it was quite expensive, right? It was costing about close to 1 million rupees, right? 700,000 to 1 million rupees is what it used to cost. Now there are companies coming forward doing designs, manufacturing it, and then supplying it in numbers, right? So people are stepping up to manufacture numbers like, if we had 100 ventilators out there until now, people are manufacturing 70 or 80 in the next month. So, and doing it at costs that are 80, 90% cheaper. This will fundamentally change how we approach healthcare, because now people will start to question, if you can do it now, why didn't we do it earlier? Right? And if we can do that in a month, why don't we continue to do that for 10 more months? What kind of healthcare infrastructure that would be, possible to build out of that? Right? So those are the questions that would get asked. And I don't know if you're aware, the government rolled out a program called as Ayushman Bharat, which essentially means Healthy India, right? That's Hindi for Healthy India. That is the world's largest healthcare insurance program that covers about around 500 million people, right? About 40% of the population, right? So it's about 500 million people are covered under that plan. So what that is doing is that is pushing healthcare spending power into small towns. Now, as where money goes, the capacities will flow. And when you reduce dramatically the cost of inputs, then there is a huge healthcare infrastructure build out that I'm seeing over the next 10 years. I think in terms of healthcare, I think we will have a far better infrastructure
a few years from now than what we have today. Probably 5x to 10x of what we have today, or more, if not more. What I personally believe, right, and we have to see if that is true, is that this will somewhere, this changes the self-image of what you are capable of as a country, as society, and as companies. If you can do this for ventilators, why can't I do this for a pacemaker? Right? I know these are different devices, but then, right, it's the switch has to happen in your mind. Why can't I do this for any other equipment? And if you can do this for medical equipment, why not for mobile phones? Why not for consumer infrastructure, consumer devices? Right? So I think this will change what we think we are capable of doing.
You know that I know what you are capable of doing, but I'm looking forward to seeing what happens when the entire population starts seeing what I already kind of see as a potential in India. So thank you very much for that overview about past, present, and future of what Corona is doing to India. Is there anything that you would like to see or hear about the situation in Germany? You've been here a number of times. I think you've stayed here months at a time. What are you curious about?
It's more about what is the feeling, right? So I do understand that you guys are also in lockdown and how the lockdowns are. But what makes me curious is what's going through the minds of a common German, right? So how are you guys taking it? And is there a feeling of hope? Is there a feeling of an impending doom? Or what is it like?
I think what is going through the minds of the average German is very individual. On the one hand, so there is, of course, a broad divide between those people who say this is a huge catastrophe and we need to make sure that the whole thing stays under control. That is, my gut feel says that is the majority of the population, but it is not as overwhelming as I would have expected. After a first shock around mid-March, many people are going back to their usual thinking mindset, and people are concerned about what this is doing to the economy, how many shops are going to have to close, how many factories have to close, how many people are going to lose their jobs. And so the pressure is mounting to get out of that, by Indian standards, very loose lockdown that we have here. And then inside of that, there is a variety of substreams building, like, for example, those people who think about what has this done in terms of good for the environment. Are the numbers going to change for environmental concerns or for climate protection concerns, as you would expect, because in a sense you could see it as a huge environmental policy experiment as well. What is it doing in terms of politics? Is it going to strengthen the extremist parties? Is it going to weaken the extremist parties? We need to make sure that social concerns are properly covered. You should know nurses are not particularly well paid in Germany. And I mean, on the one hand, there has been this event modeled after Italy, where the people stood out on their balcony and applauded for everybody who is working in healthcare now in order to support the people who are sick. But the next day, there were memes flying across the internet that said, "We don't need your applause; we need appropriate pay."
And that kind of
conversation. So it's really, really a mixed bag that we are seeing here, and also weird information coming in, even from formerly well-reputed sources. I mean, in Germany, the Robert Koch Institute is in charge of informing the population. Now the boss of the chief virologist of one of the biggest hospitals in Berlin has been a very prominent figure. Most of what they said is, as far as I can tell, very credible. Some of my medically educated friends have criticism at the edges, but the mainstream of these two sources seems to be okay. But there have also been physicians who used to be members of parliament who have raised their voice, saying things like the impact of this whole thing isn't going to be worse than an average flu season. And the numbers from Italy are very convincing to the opposite these days. Okay. And it's very, very mixed combination of different informations, and it is very hard for an average person to find their direction in there. But the underlying sentiment is either fear about the disease or frustration about the lockdown.
So what's happened? What is the impact on the social cohesion?
I think it is that too is mixed. There have been people living in Germany, especially in the big cities, is often very anonymous, unlike life in India or, for example, life in Italy. Like there are many people who attribute the difference in mortality according to Corona to the fact mm-hmm. that in Italy it is normal that people live together across generations, like children, parents, and grandparents living in one household or very close to each other with very, very, very close contact. So mm-hmm. the infection spread into the older generation in Italy very intensely, and okay. that doesn't seem to be the case here. So people live in especially in the big cities, many people live in high-rise buildings mm-hmm. and more or less don't know each other at all. But suddenly, out of the blue sky, people started to stick notes on each other's doors, especially at the doors of the elderly. If you need help, if you need somebody who goes grocery shopping for you, okay. please call me at this phone number.
Okay.
And, nice. And these things just popped up. And that is really great.
Okay.
On the other extreme, there have also been, particularly about among the young, things like Corona parties. The situation okay. here was that the government was deliberating about whether to order a lockdown or not over a weekend. So there were the first mentions of a lockdown on 12th and 13th of March, but the federal government and the state governments couldn't agree. So they okay. postponed the decision to March 16th, that's the Monday. And on that weekend, kids met at night for Corona parties with 50, 100, and 150 kids around. And that did not help. If I look at the numbers, the way I'm running the statistics, I can see a sudden peak of infections 2 weeks after that weekend.
Yes.
And also there have been videos going around social media about so-called Corona challenges. I didn't mention it explicitly, but public transportation in Germany is by and large still operational and is still being used because, okay. after all, many businesses are still operating and people need to commute to where they work. And the one Corona challenge video that I saw was a, I don't know, 15, 20, 25-year-old punk with blue hair and half-shaved head and with weird clothes. And he was mm-hmm. licking over the buttons of a ticket dispenser for public transportation just to, I don't know.
That's criminal.
Yeah, it's mindless.
Yeah.
And I think our government has, that is, if there is one piece of criticism around our official information channels like Robert Koch Institute, the government has been afraid for too long to make the possible danger of the whole thing really explicit. And that has changed only in late March, long after the lockdown has been ordered. And that was probably a mistake. But then again, you mentioned that the Indian industry is now ramping up to build ventilators and to create protective gear and so on and so forth. The situation in Germany is that there is nobody here who is actually originally manufacturing any of that. All of the supplies in that direction have been imported or have been heavily depending on imports. So now companies who are normally making a living with producing apparel, and there is, as far as I know, there is only one company who is still producing in Germany. They are shifting gear and start making masks. And suddenly the masks they make have unbelievable prices because it's all made in Germany.
Right.
And the situation around ventilators and even laboratory equipment is similar. The entire industry is shifting now away from what they used to do and how they used to do it, like a very deep manufacturing depth, depending on deep chains of suppliers for making what they are doing. And suddenly they are shifting gears from whatever they are doing normally into delivering stuff that is useful for fighting the virus. For example, breweries have started to make disinfectant from alcohol. A lot of positive stuff is happening, but from my personal point of view, a lot of stuff is happening where when I'm in a good mood, I'm scratching my head, and when I'm in a bad mood, I'm I'm getting a sore neck from shaking it.
Got it. Understood. Yeah, we have to keep a close eye on the situation as it evolves, and it's very hard to see too far ahead at this point of time.
Oh yes, there I agree. I like the expression that you used for crystal ball gazing earlier. That's more or less hits the nail on the head. I think we wrap it up for today. Thank you so much for your input. Thank you so much for your questions.
Thank you for inviting me.
It was my pleasure. I hope we have shed a light onto the situation elsewhere on the planet for a lot of people. And if there is interest, if there is curiosity, I'm looking forward to hearing from everybody who is hearing this this audio recording now. Sai and I have agreed that we would like to go into more detail on some of the topics. Please drop us a line and let us know what you're most interested in. This was Josef Dietl from Germany and
Sesha Sai from Bangalore. Thank you.
We're looking forward to hearing from you. Thank you. Bye-bye.